Let me just make sure this is working. We have a form from LSU that they would like for you to sign saying that it's okay for them to use the information. And basically, I'm going to start by asking you to say that what we're doing today is okay with you. We lost that from the first tape. These are materials that we put at the university so that people 100 years from now, when they want to know what life was like and what people did, you know, in this part of the world, back in this century, they'll be able to go to these materials and listen to them. And it's not a money-making proposition. It's simply for research purposes so that people know what life was like. So is that okay with you to record you for this?
It's okay with me.
Okay.
It's okay, Judge?
Oh, it's okay with me. Yes, sir. Like I said, I'm going to kind of be in and out. Is it okay every so often if I kind of pop in? Because I love to hear Mr. Red's stories.
By all means, please do join us. And pull up a chair if you've got time.
I might even come in and ask some of my own questions while he's here.
Oh, sure.
If that's okay.
Sure, absolutely. No, we'd love to have you. So
maybe I can start off. I have a doctor's appointment in
30 minutes. Sure. Well, go ahead and start it off.
I haven't seen the eye doctor in about 15 years, and my eyes are starting to tell me,
it's time.
See the eye doctor.
Well, I had reached a point where my arms weren't long enough. So
well, that's kind of where I am. And I can't find my glasses often enough. I'm going to have to get one of those things in time.
You said no
I got a pocket, but
I got some shirts.
I'm having trouble keeping up with my glasses.
No pocket. Mm-hmm.
Trouble keeping up with my glasses.
Miss my pocket to buy.
Mr. Red, at the club, when did you start working for Vermilion Corporation?
In the spring of 37. April.
1937. So the clubhouse had been there 37, 24, 13 years. The club had been there for about 13 years when you started. I mean, they didn't build it. You didn't help them build the original
building. I helped them add to it.
Add to it, yeah. But when y'all added to it, y'all brought carpenters in from outside?
Mr. Ben Bertrand from Pocono.
Mr. Ben Bertrand from Pocono. And what about plans? Did y'all have a set of plans that he worked from, or?
Mr. Mark told him what he wanted done.
Uh-huh. You think Mr. Mark had a plan, some plans that they had sent
from
Chicago?
No, Mr. Mark was the boss at that time.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know where he got the plan, if that's how the people wanted it, or if he wanted just to add room.
Uh-huh. Now, what do you remember when you first went to work there? What was there? What buildings were at the...
all the buildings were there.
The annex was there?
Yeah.
Yeah, the annex was there.
Oh, yeah.
So the annex was there by 1937.
Oh, yeah, the annex was there. They call it the ladies' club that housed the women that would come.
Uh-huh.
And then the husbands, you know.
And did the women come very often?
Well, there were some that would come pretty regularly.
Okay.
So I suppose the women loved that camp.
So the buildings that you added on to, I'm going to guess, were the big club and the guides' quarters?
Yeah.
Both of those were added on to. But how about the office?
No.
No, the office was always kind of like it is.
All we had to do was repair the square nails in there.
Uh-huh. Now, I'm asking these questions because, you know, we lost the guides' quarters in Ike. And I've got some guys that are coming out and trying to help us figure out, well, they're studying how it was put together because that's a different type of construction than the way they build things today. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to make plans to lift the big club. And when we lift it, I told them, I said, it's been through 3 major storms, but it's always been underwater. I said, I don't know what the wind's going to do to it. I need you to come tell me when we pick it up 10, 14 feet in the air, if it's not going to blow apart.
I don't want to be involved. I can't guarantee that.
Oh, I know. So these engineers are looking only at the big club. Okay? They look, and they're very impressed with the way it's constructed.
But what we're seeing is, it looks like the original construction was board and batten. Like the warehouse was when when you and I were working out there together. When you went out in 37, was it board and batten, and y'all put the siding, that asbestos cement siding on it later? Or was that already on?
On what?
On the big club and all the buildings.
Yeah.
You helped him put that on there? So when you went out, it was all the buildings were board and batten type construction. That's what you remember? And on the inside, in that the annex was there and all the buildings were there, these guys are wondering how they built that. Do you remember when y'all built the addition? And it's going to be interesting to see if the addition is built the same way as the original construction. It looks like they took all these boards and laid them side by side and nailed them to a 2x4 or something, top and bottom, and then stood the wall up. You don't remember?
Oh, man.
I don't either. Okay. Because the engineers were just... they were amazed and puzzled, and they said, now how did they do this, you know, and how did they join it? And what it looks like was done was the walls were put up and kind of very tentatively tacked in place, and when they put the roof on, the roof locked everything together. Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It is very well built. They were amazed at how well built.
What's amazing to me is that boat shed.
Yeah, still standing.
Standing over the canal. And it's 2x4s, and it's still there, buddy.
Now, there were some iron beams on the outside. Do you remember adding those?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And I think we've added a couple more since then.
I don't know what you did.
But just to hold it up, you know?
We'll have to put some dead men that are hold the bulkheads.
Uh-huh.
Did y'all ever rebuild the bulkhead?
We have, yes, sir. We've rebuilt the bulkheads. I'd love to bring you out there, but it's... once we get the yard cleaned up after Ike, I wanted to bring you all this winter, but it was so depressing.
Well...
I didn't want you to see that.
Not only that, I'm not solid on my feet too much.
Well, but we get one of the big boats and get you comfortable in there. We get it looking good, and you still kicking... We're going to get you out there. I promise. You and Miss Lily and Mr. Ivy. I want to do that. I want to do that for y'all. And the plant. We have a building we call the plant, where we had a generator. And they made ice out
there.
They
made ice out there. They had a set of batteries. Glass batteries. They furnished... electricity. There was an old, big old engine that you get on the wheel to start. Run the coal off.
So before we had the gas that came from Humble, the plant generated the electricity for all the buildings. And before Slimco came. And y'all had to haul coal oil out there to run that?
Yeah. And then we got some generators. That originally the generators were in the shop.
Uh-huh.
But then we built some cement forms and put them up, you know, so they'd be out of the stronger generators.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, we had to put the lights out at 9 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, that was the rule, huh?
That was the rule. Everything was tight.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. And y'all dug the pitcher pond, the pond out in front of the annex and the big club.
Yeah.
Now, remember you telling me y'all had dug that with shovels by hand.
No.
That was with the drag line?
Oh, that was with the drag line. And we filled in, you see, there was a slope in front there. It was a low place. There was a snipe.
The slope was where?
From the building. You see the ridge?
Uh-huh.
That is a marsh. We'd stand in front of the guide camp and see the rabbits come out to feed there along those roads.
So that was marsh from on the north side of the road?
There were rat beds in front there, between the canal and the yard.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, they're right outside the yard right now, the rat beds.
Well, I'm glad to hear it coming back.
Oh, yeah, muskrat? You can stand up there and watch them, even during the day. You can watch them moving around.
That's something to see.
Yeah.
It's about a quarter of.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna.
No problem. We'll be sure you get a copy of this.
Okay.
And please, by all means, do whenever you're here. You want to sit in? Just come on in and pull up a chair.
Well, good. Well, just pour your heart out, whatever you remember, Mr. Red. It's going to be good for the historians, and might even be good for us. I hope we can learn a lot.
We hope it's a win-win situation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good luck, and y'all have fun. That's the important thing.
Oh, well we had a great time last time.
Well, good.
I won't speak for Mr. Sellers, but I know we did.
Y'all want some coffee?
There's a pot of coffee if you care.
Not for me.
Well, I'm going to start by asking you again, Mr. Sellers, to give us your full name and the day you were born and where you were born and your parents' names.
I don't know exactly where I was born, but I came from Coahuila.
Mm-hmm.
My mother probably came to town for the birthing.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, the doctors would go to the house.
Right.
So I can't give you that exactly, mm-hmm. but I came from Coahuila.
Okay, and what day were you born on?
October 5th, 1917.
Mm-hmm. And your parents had, I think your mother, you said, had lived originally on
Trinity.
Okay. And your dad was from the parish also?
He was from Coahuila.
Okay.
He was raised.
As I told you with the recording the first time, the machine didn't work and we didn't miss the first couple of questions. So the first thing I want to ask you is to tell us me again the story you told us about going from Chenier O'Teague out toward, along the beach toward Marsh Island, and about all the oysters out there and the amount of oysters they used to have in Vermilion Bay and around Marsh Island.
There were oysters out there, oyster bed. Matter of fact, I had a cousin that lived, was raised on Trinity, and when I'd go over there, we'd walk over towards Marsh Island at the point,
mm-hmm.
and we'd see the oysters over there. We'd bring a jug of water and an oyster knife and get a belly full of oysters, just walk right there and pick out our oysters.
But according to the maps that we have, apparently there were a lot of reefs all the way from the shoreline all the way to Marsh Island and maybe even beyond Marsh Island.
Beyond, there were further out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Charlie Musham, Mike. You see, they leased those oyster reefs.
Mm-hmm.
The Dupreys had a reef. Charlie Musham, Mike had a reef. My grandfather, Paulin Laplace, had a reef. Paul Laplace was the son of Paulin.
Mm-hmm. Now, they were leasing when you were young and were going out there? They were already leasing those lands? And they'd go out and tong them, I guess, to?
They'd tong them.
Mm-hmm. And how would they get them? I assume they're shipping them to Abbeville from there?
Well, they'd put them on these oyster boats. They all had a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd load their boats and they'd bring them in.
Now, the oysters, I'm guessing, for the Dupuis were going to the restaurant, but what
the
about...
The restaurant was open at that time.
Okay, now what about you talked about the others who were your Was it your grandfather you said?
My grandfather was on that side of the bridge, you know, just past the bridge. It was Florimo Malibeck. He was an old Swiss. I'd married one of my grandfather's sisters. Mm-hmm. And he had the store and sold the...
He just sold through his store locally?
Oh, no, he sold them from his shop.
Ah, and where would they ship them? To Abbeville?
Well, I don't know if they were shipping them at that time. Mm-hmm. They sold them locally. Mm-hmm. Nicola does. I can remember that.
Times have changed.
Oh, yes.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was you had described cutting a drainage through the marsh grass. Can you tell me again what you used to use and how you used to cut a drainage through the...
Well, we stomp them.
Mm-hmm. Did you use a bench shovel at all for...
Well, we used a bench shovel when we made ditches between Promising Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And the levee.
Mm-hmm.
We'd get out there and one on each side, scoop a bench shovel like a hoe.
Right.
And clean it off.
But to cut it, a drainage, you would just get out and walk it then, is that?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the next thing I want to talk about is the cattle industry. Because where I grew up, we grew cattle, and so that's been a personal interest to me. And you were talking about the millers and how they have cattle drives. Now, the cattle drives would start in the Grand Chenier area, is that?
Yeah, they would start over in Cameron.
In Cameron. And they would just run them along the beach?
Run them along the beach.
Now, as far as Chenier Teague?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that, when I listened back to our conversation last week, one of the questions I had that I didn't think to ask you at the time was about fresh water. When they're driving the cattle along the beach there, where would they find fresh water for the...
Well, I guess it was the streams that were flowing to the gulf. Mm-hmm. They get the bio canal, they drink, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they got to the Chenier Teague area, there were ponds out there, or where would they get fresh
water? Sand Lake and things like that. They call Sand Lake back of the McElhenney property, between the McElhenney and the locks.
Mm-hmm.
That was the channel that would go out of Chenier Teague would come from Sand Lake. It would drain that area of the marsh.
Mm-hmm.
And that my grandfather had a boat that I understand, you see. And he'd go to Lake Otto or Morgan City or wherever, you see, to get supplies and lumber or whatever.
Now, how big were the herds that they would drive? Do you have any recollection of how many head of cattle they would normally drive?
I have no idea, sir.
Okay.
The families would get together and they'd lease that land.
So they'd all pool their cattle
together and drive them.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, they would swim them across the Calcasieu River over at the Cameron, you know, in that, they called the big marsh and all of that. San Osavo was in charge of that. He was the sheriff. When my son went to work for the sheriff department. Mm-hmm. At one time, he would work for Union Oil at the camp there.
Mm-hmm.
He'd make Monell spurs, and he'd come at the shop and work them out. I got to know him pretty good, and when he got to be sheriff, well, he gave my son a job.
Mm-hmm. Now, when they got to this area, they had special areas that they would keep them? I mean, were there higher ridges where they put them when they got...
Well, it was livable in that area.
Mm-hmm. Just generally speaking. Now, Judge asked me to ask you to tell me about an area called the Stomp.
Stomp, that was Union Oil before you get to the camp. That was a ridge that would go all the way to Pagon Island. Mm-hmm. The when they'd work the cattle over there, hell, at one time those cowboys would bring their wives and kids that had those old Model T's. They'd drive them all the way to the Stomp in Model T's.
Hmm. So if the ground was high enough for them to?
Yeah, at that time, before they blocked it off with canals.
Right.
For drilling canals. Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
It is.
Now, they would keep horses. You said they would go by Model T out there. They would keep horses out in the sun.
Well, the men would ride the horses.
Oh, I see. And the families would go in the...
Families would go in over Model T.
I see. Back in the early 1900s and the late 1800s, there were cattle drives that would come from Texas all the way across and sometimes end up in places like Abbeville, where they would put them on cars and ship them off by train. Was any of that going on after you started work for the corporation?
No, I wasn't familiar with
that. That was before your time?
My daddy told me many a time what they do that on the way to Kaplan, there's a house out in the pasture over there, big house. That was my great-grandfather's home. Matter of fact, he was living with his son there, Obey Sellers.
Mm-hmm.
But his name was Camille. And there was my daddy, Obey, Remy, my grandfather, and Davie were the sons. And my daddy was Remy's son.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in wintertime, what they do, they drive those cattle across to Farquhar Island over there and turn them loose in the woods for the winter. He said there was some pheasants in that prairie grass at that time.
Well, that's interesting. They still had them as late as that. I know they had them as late as about 1880 in around Lafayette. It's interesting that they were still around that late over here, too. Now, when they would drive the cattle up into the Chenero Teague area, was that just on a seasonal basis? I mean, they keep them there?
Yeah.
During which seasons, Mr. Sellers?
Winter.
In winter. And then where would they drive them when summer starts?
Bring them in the fall and bring them back in the spring.
Okay.
Because the mosquitoes got too bad.
Right. But when they left Chenero Teague, they went back to the Cameron area? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about branding? When, do you have any idea when they would?
Well, whenever there was a pen at Pecan Island,
mm-hmm.
and or they'd brand them at Mulberry. But, mm-hmm. well, when I was mixed up with it, they were running in Pecan Island, and see the road was built, and they'd drive them on through.
Mm-hmm. You talked about them just turning the cattle loose. Were there still any kind of predators, animals that would attack the calves? Back in those days, were there still coyotes? Or is that something that has come back?
When I retired, the wolves were beginning to come in.
Mm-hmm. But earlier than that, there was nothing like that that was attacking the cattle?
Not at first.
Okay. About when did they start coming back? Do you remember?
Well, that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They evidently followed the beach. Oh, yes, there were several killed. Matter of fact, our guest, the people that own the stock that I can't, they come hunting, and I had told some of the Michael Hennies from New Orleans that there was particularly one that had a toe missing.
You could see it on the tracks?
Could see the track. Told me I was wrong because the wolves hadn't been here, and I said, okay. So one night they walked at the camp for a meeting, and they cut through the yard, either chasing a deer or something. And next morning, man, talk about a wreck. And next morning, he said, well, was that what you were talking about? I said, yes. But he said, you're right.
Now, what about, are there still bears?
I never have seen a bear.
Okay, because at one time back in the late 1800s, there were still bears in this area from Abbeville on down. I was just curious.
Oh, there was a bear caught at the White property at Intercoastal. Mm-hmm. He'd come across from Live Oak. That's at Banco.
Right.
And the White property, and he. The corn that Mr. Dave White had, a patch of corn across the edge of the marsh there, and they caught him alongside the road. I had a bite of that bear. Mm-hmm. I forget what year it was, mm-hmm. but there was one caught.
I wanted to ask you a couple of other questions about cattle. Mr. Sellers, when you were little, the cattle that were here were, I guess, just a mix of whatever could survive in the marsh area. Did people at some point make an attempt to bring in something like Herefords or Jerseys or
no.
Some? There was never an attempt to do that.
Oh, not until I was grown.
Mm-hmm. About when did they try that? I'm wondering just how successful that was.
It was. They'd bring them in for milk, mm-hmm. milk cow.
Right.
But the Jerseys didn't do in the marsh.
What about the white faces? Could they handle? Because I know some people in the northern prairie, they have a
short-legged,
problem.
Short-legged, broad and short-legged. The first one didn't succeed all that much, but after they got bred and mixed with Brahmas and one thing and the other, they survived.
Mm-hmm.
They did well.
But it just took time.
Oh, yeah.
One of the problems that the newspapers report back in the beginning about 1880 when they first started reporting about the settlements in this part of the world up through the 1920s is that whenever there was a hard winter, lots and lots of cattle died out here. Was that still the case, say, from the 1930s through the 1940s?
Well, when you had a freeze here, in those days, it stayed frozen for a week.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them go to the, see, they get the heat from the water. You know, it was warmer than,
yes,
and they'd get on the edge of those levees and slide. Their feet would weaken, you know, and into that, and they'd get in that cold water.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't survive.
Right. The carcasses, I guess, were just left for the buzzards when.
That's it.
One of the things that the newspapers report pretty often too is the outbreaks of charbon. How was that a frequent thing when you were little?
Yeah. Oh yeah. People had. Sometimes they would clean them out of the work stock,
mm-hmm.
like mules, you know. They'd dig a hole out there and do purposes in until it was over. Then they'd stop it early.
Mm-hmm. Now, how would the people treat it? I mean, because people get anthrax too.
Yeah.
So what would they do when a person came
well,
down?
I was told at Mulberry they didn't have no doctor. They treat themselves. They'd heat a knife and cauterize it. Burn it off.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads me to a question I had earlier about how people would treat themselves. Because where I grew up, you know, out in the country, there were no doctors, you know, before, I guess, about World War II. So what would people do to treat illness when it popped up? I mean, did they go to a traiteur? Did they get find some kind of plants that would help fight the disease? How did they treat disease back in
right.
those
we
days?
Had, we had traiteurs in those days. We had several good ones.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things would they treat? I know my wife's grandfather treated sunstroke, but I know people.
I had a sister-in-law that would treat for bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
I had an old cook at the camp that went fishing, and he broke he had a pint jar, you know how that neck?
Yes, sir.
It broke in the bottom of one of these aluminum boats, and he stepped on it, and that thing was on each side. I had to take my fingers and break it open, you see. And after it was broken, naturally, it wouldn't hold it anymore. And I couldn't very well take him to town because he'd probably bred to death. So I knew my sister-in-law, she lived back and over with her,
mm-hmm.
could do that. And I called her. It was amazing. Another time I castrated a calf for one of my uncles at an Ocean City. And he was the one that he got that found something to fuss about all the time, you know. So I called my sister-in-law, stopped it right there, and that made him a pretty calf. He'd bled, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about plants? Did people go out in the woods?
Well, there were some plants, Oignon Dali, they called. That was something that was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And put that in whiskey.
Oh, and what would they treat with that?
Well,
mm-hmm.
everything. Anything they thought it was a good excuse, take a good swig. Yeah.
When did the area get its first doctor? I'm talking about the Pecan Island.
Well,
was there ever a doctor?
Cheney Digg had a Dr. Segura, they called. Matter of fact, he had married my great grandmother. She was married to Laplace,
mm-hmm.
and she had that family, my grandfather. And he had property at Cheney Digg. Don't ask me how or what, but they still own the biggest part of Cheney Digg. And he was a doctor. In those days, I don't know how much education the man had, probably experience mostly, but, oh yeah.
Two things actually, before we change subjects. Back in the early 1900s, the state passed a law that saying that people raising cattle had to dip their cattle
mm-hmm.
in those vats to fight the tick. And I know it caused big problems in a lot of different places. Back home in my parish, I know they arrested, or at least brought charges against hundreds and hundreds of people because they refused to dip their cattle.
Dip the cattle.
Was that still going on here? I mean, were they dipping people?
Oh, we had an old Jersey cow. I lived with my grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to bring the old call and throw in the ride.
Now, how would you do that? How would you get it in? You put it in a chute and force it? And just force it to get in the...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, how often would you dip a cow?
I forget if it was a month or so. It was so often, you know.
Now, people were pretty good about following those rules here.
Oh, yeah. It was at the park, Como Park over there. He had it alongside the road going to the back, you know, where you go into the park. And
everybody used that?
Everybody used the bike. They tried to say that cancer today was caused by dipping cattle. I want to ask you something. Why didn't the calves die? They had to circle those teeth.
Right.
And naturally, that would be dripping off points for the dip.
Mm-hmm.
How could those calves survive? I don't know of any calves that died.
Do you know what actually they put in the dipping vat to kill the ticks?
It was dip. They call it dip.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it was strong enough. I had a buddy that lived on Cheney Tig. He killed 3 horses. He didn't cut his dip enough, and he thought he was gonna wash them off with that solution, so that hair, you know, when a hair would fall off and it'd come out slick. Those horses walked, I doubt it, they walked a mile from his house down the woods.
And just fell over and died?
Yeah, it burned them to death. That was strong stuff.
Mm-hmm. So they would get this stuff already mixed to put it in the vat?
They put it in there with 5-gallon can.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I know I had interviewed the widow of a Mrs. Leon Packer. He was a veterinarian. And he used to fly down, or she used to fly him, I think, down to this area.
I don't know who would fly who, but when I was a kid, I heard talk about Leon Packer.
Okay. Were they people still using vets? Here in the 30s during the Great Depression,
during
World War II, would they come in from Abbeville or?
Well, I knew them, but I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. But they would come from Abbeville or Capitol.
Well, there was one living here.
Oh, there was one here. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then we had a vet that came here after the war. He lived over there next to two propeller shop.
Hmm.
His daddy was a priest.
Mm-hmm.
He would say mass at church there. You know, overseas they could marry at that time. And they,
Well, I'd like to change subject just a little bit.
Okay.
And talk a little bit about what people did in their everyday lives, because that's the kind of thing that, unless you tell us, people are never going to know. Let me ask this question. Just how important was the family?
Well, the family was right there. It was it.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of things did the family do to keep those bonds, to keep the family tight, strong?
Well, every time we needed something or something, we'd help each other.
Mm-hmm. I know where I grew up, people grew cotton, and when somebody was sick and they couldn't bring in the crop, everybody in the neighborhood would get together and bring it in. Was that kind of thing going on here?
Oh, yes. My brother-in-law, Johnny Weiss, he had a neighbor, Tina Truva, you know, everybody worked together. Well, he ruptured panic one year, and he couldn't work. John and his sons, went and plowed up his land and harvested his crop. Oh yeah, that's one special case I remember.
Well, that was a common thing where I grew up. Now, families back home would get together every weekend, especially in the wintertime, for veillées. Did families do that?
Oh yeah, hell. When I was a kid, I can remember they'd come, they call it a garabotage, cotton, the last harvest, they'd save and throw it in a room, and then the neighbors would get together and pull it out, save
a garabotage.
A garabotage.
I'd never heard of that, but that's interesting. And they just visit and...
That's right. Made candy and drink coffee.
Now, the kids would help out with this too, or was it just...
Well, if they were big enough. If they were too small, you know, they'd stick a dog going, you know how...
Sure. No, no, I picked cotton, so I know what you're talking about. Well, people would... I know where I grew up, and when there was a VA, people were always telling stories. Was that part of it here too?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of stories would people tell each other?
Well, what? Some things that some didn't want to hear. I mean, you know, telling somebody else or something like that. You know, there was always a rascal in the bunch.
Now, would they tell stories about times past or...
Times past.
Too?
Oh, yeah.
Did y'all still have bal de maison?
Well, oh yeah, they didn't have no dance hall.
Well,
I can remember on the way down the coast, there was an old house, it was a good-sized house, it was Sorbet, they called him. I forget what his name is. But anyway, Pete Noel was a rascal, him and Clyde Shorty, sometimes they'd meet up, they had to fight. And they'd come in, Sorbet would crawl under the dance hall. They'd do it, they knew he was going to do it, so he was going to get out of the way, so let them have that fun.
Well, let me start off by asking you, because the people who are going to be listening to this will have no idea what a bal de maison was all about. Can you tell me how people would go about organizing it, where it was held?
Well, they'd meet up at a certain place, an old building.
Would people take turns having it, or was it always at the same place?
Some places it was, like this place where Sorbet Dance Hall, and other places it was
just at a house.
Next Saturday we'd have it at my house.
Now, how would they get the word out to people in the neighborhood?
Everybody would either go to church or...
Okay, because back where I grew up, usually they would name one of the kids and say, you go tell everybody we're going to have, you know, a bal of some de soirée.
Too soft.
So people would just meet at church more or less here to get the word out, do you think?
The word would get out. I mean, I was in the marshal where I knew the price of fur. We'd meet up.
Well, that's... okay, so at the bal de maison, about how many people would normally show up over here in where you grew up?
Well, the closest neighbors anyway, and then the kids, you see.
And they would chaperone the girls?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Now, the mothers would all sit in the room to supervise. My grandfather used to tell me how when he was growing up, you were never alone at all with a girl. They'd walk, you know, if you walked with them, there was somebody ahead of you and somebody behind you.
I was doodle-bugging in, I forget if it was Thibodeau or Homa, I believe it was. Anyway. I met this girl at one of these places where we'd eat, you see. And I said, try to get closed. She was sitting in the dark in the back room over there, but she had a straight eye on the front room. Oh yeah, I'll never forget that.
Now, who would play at these things that you talked about?
By the local, band? You had people that would play. I had a brother-in-law, Oreo White, and there's a Jewish rear. He's got a little joint just before you get to the bridge.
At Farkett Island?
At Farkett Island. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These guys that get together, you
okay.
See.
Okay, well, let me ask you. You said there were some guys who would get together. What kind of instruments would they play? Was
they'd play either an accordion or a keyfad, they call it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure, triangle.
And a washboard, a guitar. Or they'd make it go. So they could stomp.
Did you ever hear of a musician named Bascom Mutha?
I heard so many until I don't remember.
Okay. The reason I ask is a lot of people who played said they learned from him, mm-hmm. and nobody apparently knows
anything
everybody
about him. Learned from somebody else.
Right.
Just like the kids that learned from their daddy or mm-hmm. uncle or somebody. Oh, yeah.
When you went to a dance hall, do they charge you to get in?
No. Oh, no.
Just whatever you bought to drink over there? Now, at a house dance...
At the time, there was no drinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. At a house dance, I know where in my part of the world, you weren't allowed to drink inside at a house dance. You had to go outside.
Yeah.
Was this the same thing here?
Oh, yeah. You couldn't drink here. At Shinnytig, when I worked over there, there was an old lady who would make the best wine. She'd make muscadine wine, you know, to get the kids to pick them for it. Would sell the doggone stuff at 20 cents a gallon. But it was good wine. And I had an old buddy over there named Tom Foster. He'd hide his wine in the mesquites,
mm-hmm.
see, and but they'd watch him and
steal
his wine. And he was a crippled man, but all his strength was there. That man could pick up. There was an old truck over there when they wanted to change the tire. He picked the damn thing up. It was done right now. Or it would lock the wheels, you know. You'd have to pick it up and straighten it off.
Now, the dance halls back where I grew up were pretty rough places. Was that true over here, too?
Yeah, especially over at Forked Island.
Mm-hmm.
What
do you think that is? Is it because people coming in from different areas?
Yeah, people wouldn't intermix in those mm-hmm. days, you know. A stranger would come, they didn't want them to tomcat around the sisters or the girls.
Mm-hmm.
Or no.
So there were a lot of encounters there. I know there was a lot of violence where I grew up, and very often somebody ended up getting stabbed or shot or something.
Mm-hmm. There was a fight all the time here, mostly.
Now, was there, back home, they'd hire somebody to serve essentially as a bouncer, I guess, or constable is what they call them sometimes. Did you have that here, too?
Yeah.
Try to keep the peace? And
try to. We didn't care for, especially when somebody would get hurt.
Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about the news spreading, Mr. Sellers. Just how much were people up on things like state politics, national politics.
Oh, cool, that does, man. He'd let you know.
So people, how did people get the word here? Did they begin to get radios in the 1930s?
Well, whoever had a radio, it was open door.
Okay. So people would visit to listen, or they just...
Oh, yeah.
Now, these were, I guess, the battery kind of radios, the battery types?
At first, we had batteries. Mm-hmm.
That was...
Matter of fact, I had the camp, working at the camp, and I had an old... You have one of your batteries that big and about so wide, you know, you sit in the bottom of your radio, all the radios, it'd be the thing in those days. And I had one over there, that's how we heard about Pearl Hall.
Ah. Now, you listened to, what kind of programs did you listen to? Because I know they had all kinds of, in addition to music, I assume you listen to music too?
Well, there were certain programs that we wouldn't miss.
Okay, well, tell me which ones you listened to.
Could Not Do.
Okay. What other programs did you listen to? Did you listen to things like Amos and Andy?
Yeah, things like that.
Okay. And which stations were you catching out here?
Most of Lafayette.
Okay. Because I know there were also clear channel stations you could get. There was one with WWL in New Orleans had.
WWL was one of them.
I knew there were a bunch of Mexican stations that would come in here too, but there was one, there was some from Texas, I think, that were clear channel and would come through here too.
Well, they'll catch anything over there.
Whatever
we could catch.
Mm-hmm. What about music? Did you listen to music at all? On the radio?
Anything but pastime. Because sometimes I stayed over there by my whole weekend by myself.
Mm-hmm.
See if somebody had to stay there for the insurance.
Well, I can see where a radio would be a nice thing to have.
That was the reason I had it. And I was single, you see. Mm-hmm. All the others, you weren't getting enough money to buy a radio. You had to supply the family.
How long would a battery last, Mrs. Selma?
Oh, those big batteries, they would last maybe 6 months.
Hmm.
Oh, they lasted. Because I had to work, I couldn't listen to the thing 24 hours a day.
So when it died, you traded in at the store?
No. Oh, no. All you could do is throw it away.
Ah. Okay. And just buy a new one?
No way to charge it.
Mm-hmm.
$10 maybe.
Well, speaking of buying things, where did you go to when you needed something? Where did you go to the store? What?
Locally.
Locally, right. Where would you go though to?
There was a store. It was my buddy, next to the railroad track where the Abbeville Hardware is at now. Mm-hmm. It was Doulas Mars. I first started working at Landry's store where the Black restaurant is right now. That's where he started working for the old Landry. And then...
So you'd come to Abbeville to show?
Huh?
You'd come to Abbeville to show?
Yeah.
Hmm. And how would you get here? You come up by boat on the...
Boat, we had to come up by boat.
Hmm. The stories back around my era when people were growing up, they talk about during the Depression about people making clothes out of flour sacks. Did they do that here too?
I had an old buddy would make me some shorts out of flour sacks. And feed sacks.
Mm-hmm.
He'd buy... Church. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, man. I was brought the boy, Mr. Donahue, here. Came out one time and we got a bunch of sawgrass color in there. So I stripped. And, man, I had big old flower. You know, and he looked at me. He didn't say nothing. But what the hell, man? I had That's what I had to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, I wore them. Shirts too.
What? I assume there were stores at Pecan Island and places like that for the locals. What did they kind of things that they carry in them? Just general dry goods or
general things? Yeah, well, yeah. They'd bring stuff would come in on the mail boat. Mr. Pete Dash and were in the boat.
But it was still worth your while to go to Abbeville to shop.
Well, I live here.
Mm-hmm.
See, I had an aunt that I'd come to Abbeville one weekend, and I'd go to their house and
they
always
okay.
off on till I made his own, like the fella said. Just love to be with them.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about this about what people ate, Mrs. Sellers. Now, I know that there were seasonal differences and you ate things, whatever was what was in the garden.
Being grown, oh yes.
Now, what about wintertime? What kinds of things did you all eat in wintertime?
Well, they canned.
Mm-hmm.
These old women knew how to can stuff. And hey, we always, like potatoes, we'd grow potatoes and put them in a mound.
Mm-hmm.
Cover them with dirt, or put them in a potato house, they call them.
Right. Do you all salt meat over here?
Oh, Jesus Christ, yes. Oh, yeah, we call that a pork gitty.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring it to Bill. I had a meat market right there at the red light where they have that theater there on the corner in Abbeville. We're on that side, that's Bill over there. And we bring him up our jar, and he'd fill it up for so much, you know, and salt meat.
Did they seal it here back home they would melt lard and put it on top to seal it to keep?
Oh, yes, the sausage and salt mm-hmm. meat and everything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about boucheries? Did,
yes.
Now, back home, people, you usually had so many in a neighborhood and they would each take a turn.
Mm-hmm.
How did it work over here?
It worked fine. I was into it when I lived in Rice School.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go over calf, especially for the boucherie.
Mm-hmm. For your turn?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. It was on a Friday, I believe it was here. And,
Now, back home, sometimes they had people who instead of giving a calf would serve as a, would butcher the calf. Was that the same thing here, or did people just take turns butchering the?
Well, there was a certain place we'd bring the calf and butcher it,
mm-hmm.
then they'd petition the meat.
Okay. And everybody would just come and get their share?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We'd get together and butcher it.
Mm-hmm. Now, would people cook some?
Not necessary.
Okay. Back
but in the country boucheries, they cook.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Then back home, they generally cook. Okay, let me just check on this. Because we're just... Okay, Mrs. Sellers, we're back. Let's see. Can you talk a little bit, Mr. Sellers, about what people, I know back where I grew up, people did things on a seasonal basis. Every season they had certain things that they had to do. And I assume the same thing was true here, even though it was, you know, it was quite different from where I grew up. Can you tell me a little bit about what people did? I guess let's start with the spring, things that they had to do and it had to be done in the spring.
Yeah, you, thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew.
I figured by now your throat might be dry.
Thank you. out, Mrs. Ellis. Well, see, back home, people, you know, there were certain times when you had to plow, there were certain times you had to build fence, you had certain times you had to do this, that, and the other. And I was just trying
to... You build fence any time, because that old bull had built across over there and he was coming through, buddy.
Well, what did people do here, you know, in the spring, Mrs. Sellers, that they only did in the spring?
Well, usually they had these cattle drives.
Okay.
Brought them back, things like that. And we grease up the traps, things like that. It had to be done. Because if you just let them rust in a pile,
you couldn't use them again?
No.
Now, when the summer came around, what did people do here? Now, I realize if you're working out in the marshes there, it must be a huge problem with the mosquitoes and the gnats and everything else.
Well, in the spring, we had, like George was saying, that big building had that chimney was as big. It took logs. So we'd have firewood for that chimney. Mm. But in the spring, we'd use a crosscut saw and build smoke and chop for the kitchen stove at the guide camp. Because it would rot, you see.
Right. And so you couldn't leave it there too long.
No.
Where would you go to find your firewood?
Well, we had to bring it in from under course.
Okay.
One year, Mr. Mark, he didn't believe in taking off for Good Friday. We probably gonna bring a load of firewood on the board, and it got rougher than sank the whole work. He didn't roll no more.
Okay, but now when the fall came around.
In the fall, we got ready to hunt, trap. We had to clean out those trenches to go to the blind. Oh, it was busy then.
But not as busy as in the winter then, I assume. Winter was...
Well, it was more busy because we had to please the outside people. The people we worked for.
Right, but they would come in. When would the people start coming in from the outside?
Well, when the hunting season opened, in October, November.
Okay. Well, that's a little earlier than I thought it was. So it's in October when people started coming here to hunt ducks. And how long did the season run?
Well, it ran until January, early part of February. But January, in those days, you could hunt ducks. The limit was 25. You know, you had ducks. It wasn't like it is now, you got no more ducks. But it's not only that no more feed either. You know, it's the vegetation is all gone.
Now, people, I assume, all had their household gardens?
Oh, yes.
What kinds of things do you remember them growing, Mr. Salas?
Squash, okra, cucumbers, tomatoes, radish. The general cabbage.
Do they grow turnips here too?
That's what I was trying to remember to pronounce turnips. Oh yeah, hell.
Yeah.
We turn up a levee over there at the camp, and I just throw seeds out then. We had turnips and mustard the whole year.
Mm-hmm. While I'm thinking about it, the newspapers talk about people at Grand Chenier growing watermelons and shipping them at one time. Do you remember them ever doing that?
I don't do that, but I remember that people had a track alongside the road. They'd grow that corn. And, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, those old Dahmers. Each one of them had a place like that. They'd plow that up with a mule. Yeah, it was a little bigger than a garden.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. You talked about, last time we were together, you talked about schooners coming in along the coast from Abbeville. Do you have any recollection of who was operating the schooners, Mr. Sullivan?
No. Oh, I remember the Joby Chaff.
Mm-hmm.
It was a paddle wheel.
Paddle wheel, and I actually have a picture of that.
I knew the old man that operated.
Well, according to the newspapers, there was a time when some of those small boats actually came out into the Gulf and went up along the coast here and brought goods from Abbeville to mm-hmm. some of the coastal communities.
They did that and they were in moonshine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I read an article not too long ago. I'm Alone was one of the boats.
In fact, that's probably the single most controversial episode in all of Prohibition, and it started, I believe, just off Marsh Island or in Vermilion Bay.
I remember.
Do you remember hearing people talk about that?
For sure. I worked with a mine that operated one of their boats.
Oh, really? Well, tell me how they used to.
They offload.
What kind of boats were they offloading to? I mean, these were little fishing boats, or?
Anything that they could.
Anything that would float?
Float in. And they knew the entrances, you see. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you about this, because there is a newspaper article in the Abbeville paper about, right after the I'm Alone incident, they found a boxcar full of liquor in Gaydon that had been apparently taken off the boat, moved inland, and they put it in a rice dryer, and then eventually moved it onto a boxcar. And somebody in the railroad smelled a rat. But do you have any idea where that liquor was going?
No.
Okay, I just wondered if people. Know. They didn't know themselves. I suspect the people who
it was a job.
Right. No, I understand that. It was a good paying job, according to them.
They give them so much, or they didn't give them a kiss of whiskey or something. They had their little fix.
But they, do you have any idea where they were going? You said they brought the boats in. I mean, was there? I'm just curious because that's what we don't really know about the whole story right now. Is after it was taken off the big boats, put on the little boats, where it ended up inside, because we know they brought them up the bayous and the back ways and all of this, but where it ended up is...
I have no idea.
Okay. Back home, not many people were caught doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if there was the same thing here. Not many people got...
No, there's a case where some young boys, the age of moonshine, were unloading. There was a barge of dope was unloaded here. But some of our local boys, two or three of them, went to the pen. But they were responsible people that owned the barge and supervised the damn thing, and these kids went to...
They're the ones who went to the pen.
They're the ones who went to the pen, and that name was never mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that seems the way things usually go. Was there any trade with Galveston back before World War II that you remember? Because earlier in the 1900s, there were still boats that came out from Galveston over here to trade.
I heard my grandfather talk about Galveston. Either he went up there mm-hmm. with his or something. And it's odd, I went swimming in that canal that water would drain that out before the storm stopped up the entrance, you see, and it would run along the edge of Trinity Teague, and you had some big oaks up there. I guess that's how it got settled,
mm-hmm.
because those people were looking for timber to repair their boats or whatever, and they seen those oaks growing there.
Right. Do you remember, was there any activity after you started working for the Vermilion Corporation in the upper part of the parish where people were draining lands? I mean, was that still a big ongoing operation?
You mean?
In the parish, the lower part of Vermilion Parish, I mean, were people, before World War II, people were still actively draining?
Yes. I can remember when I was a kid, past where I lived, man, you'd look at that and you'd see it was gray with ducks. It was still a coulee bâton, as they call it, comes on through. Well, they cleaned all of this out now and it's drained it. They drained again. The Sagreros are even forming the marsh right mm-hmm. up back of that, in the lock.
Now they were using steam pumps or gas powered pumps. What do you remember? What they were using to get the water off?
They were using the suction pumps. As a matter of fact, one of the Segura's brother-in-law, Isaac's brother-in-law, he slipped and he got caught in the suction. He drowned down there. They didn't know what was the matter. They had to stop the pump and dive down there and pull him out. Mm.
So these were big pipes. When we met last time, Mrs. Sellers, you talked to us about people going to work for their oil companies as soon as they could because of the amount of money that they paid. Do you have any recollection of when people in the Coney Island area and areas like that started working for the offshore companies? I assume some of them, I know, well, that's why I'm asking, did they do that? Because I know in other areas, people started working offshore, they do that for so many weeks and they come back and do something, you know, work the land on their time off. Did people over in that area, the Chenier O'Teague, the Pecan Island area, begin to do that also?
Yeah, they worked, but they worked pretty regularly here.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that, Mrs. Sellers, that they
were employed.
Okay, right, but I mean, this like 14 on, 14 off, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing? Okay. When you told me last time that you had worked for the Vermilion Corporation from 37 to 87. Now, in all those years that you were out there, how many times do you remember a hurricane surge coming across the Chenier's?
There were several times, but we didn't notice them as hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just bad weather.
Right. But how many times do you, I mean, this we're talking about several times that the water came across the ridges?
That was 57, I believe. Huh?
Right, Audrey.
Audrey.
Right.
And in those intervals. Mm-hmm.
But there were other times too, not just all
40.
Day?
No. How was that then 40?
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. If 40 had a tidal surge too, or if just, I know there was a lot of rainfall, but there was a tidal surge also?
Yeah, we had plenty of water. That was the last time my daddy was out there. Mm-hmm. We had the line back of the packing plant, the rice mill packing plant there.
Yes, sir.
You know, walk home, we had water to our waist, and he had kidney stones, but it inflamed his kidneys enough until he never could come back.
Yeah. Well, and you think that aggravated it, mister?
Yeah.
Walking through the water like that?
See, he should have been operated, but his other kidney couldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, people didn't give kidneys. I could have gave kidney probably, mm-hmm. but we didn't know about it. I think about it often now. I supported my dad and mother for 12 years. Yet he stayed suffering. His fingers are all done.
I think that's really about it. The one question I want to ask you before we stop is how, when you work in the marsh like that, how do you deal with the mosquitoes and the snakes and the gnats and everything else? For somebody not coming from the marshes, who didn't grow up in the marshes, it's curious to me how you're able to deal with that.
Sometimes I find them between my feet. I was just a fortunate man. I seen one of those storms, I believe it was before Audrey. You'd open the door, they'd be in the top of the door, stretched on the crack. You'd open the door, go and snake and fall to the floor. Or you'd take a shirt, you'd have hung up a shirt, they'd be in the pants, they'd be in the pocket, you had to, or your shoes, shake them out. You know, they'd hover up.
And what about the mosquitoes? How do you handle that?
They bite. That's all I can tell you.
You just let them bite it? Did you all have something that
we
made something?
But in that time, it was not much citronella or stuff like that, you know.
Well, I just wondered if you all had made something yourselves, some kind of natural thing to, you just let them bite.
We had hide.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough. But still didn't bite too much. I mean, they didn't bother us too much. It was a damn deer flies. Boy, he didn't give it to you.
Well, I've been bitten by those, so I know what you're talking about. Well, Mrs. Sellers, I want to tell you how much we appreciate your time and your sharing these memories with us. Like I said, 100 years from now, somebody's listening to this, and what you share with us is the only way they're going to know what life was like for you and for people of your generation.
Well, I guess you're going to have other people that can explain it to you better than me, but I'm not
I doubt that, Mr. Sellers.
Thank you for letting me share it with you.
No, sir, thank you.